Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. We are tackling a book today that didn't just, you know, record history. It feels like it almost manufactured a national identity.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
We are journeying back, way back to the 8th century, to unpack Bede's, well, colossal work, the ecclesiastical history of the English people.
It really is monumental. And our mission today, I think, is to get past just the dates and the names, right? We want to extract Bede's core argument, his political and theological point.
Yeah, what was he really trying to do? Exactly.
Right.
He set out to answer this really profound question. How did this chaotic mess of pagan warring Germanic tribes,
yeah,
you know, the Angles, Saxons, Jutes, how did they transform into this single unified Christian thing called the Gens Anglorum, the English people? It's like the ultimate origin story and the relevance. I mean, it feels huge even now. Bede basically handed them the foundational story, the narrative that let all these different groups see themselves as like one nation with a shared spiritual purpose.
Mm. It really shows how a shared belief system, could be religious, could be secular, is maybe the most powerful glue for political unity ever.
So who was the architect of this narrative? The Venerable Bede.
That's him. He lived roughly 673 to 735 CE. And yeah, people rightly call him the father of English history.
Okay, Venerable Father of English History, the name suggests authority. But what actually gave this one Benedictine monk, you know, the credibility to write the defining history of an entire emerging nation?
Well, I think it boils down to two main things, access and method.
Okay.
So Bede spent his entire life at the twin monasteries of Wearmouth-Jarrow up in Northumbria. Now, that wasn't some quiet backwater.
Right.
That library was, you could argue, one of the very best in Western Europe at the time, just packed with manuscripts from Rome, from Gaul, everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So he had this incredible access to primary sources.
Okay, so he had the goods. What about the method?
Ah, well, this is where he was just light years ahead.
Yeah.
He learned Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. He meticulously cited his sources. I mean, he even referenced official letters from the Pope.
Wow.
And get this, he developed the Anno Domini dating system, the AD system that, well, we still use today. That kind of scholarly precision was almost unheard of then.
Okay, so the rigor is undeniable. But you mentioned his agenda earlier.
Exactly.
That precision lends massive weight to his claims. But here's the crucial bit. Bede wasn't just some detached observer in jotting things down. He was absolutely an insider, a deeply devout Northumbrian monk living and breathing this new Christian culture.
But he was also this synthesizing scholar. And he used that that incredible rigor to give almost unchallengeable authority to his purpose, which was essentially crafting a story where the victory of the Roman Church and the unification of the English people felt inevitable. Like it was all predetermined by God's plan.
So the rigor isn't just about getting facts right. It's about legitimizing a very specific outcome. Okay, that brings us to the book's central idea then. If this is history as nation building, what's the core argument? What's he selling?
Well, the main premise is pretty straightforward, but it's huge in scope.
Yeah.
Basically, the conversion of the Anglo-Saxons wasn't just some, you know, historical accident or political maneuvering.
Okay.
For Bede, it was the triumph of divine providence. God, he argues, was actively guiding these people through cycles of, well, sin and redemption, guiding them towards their ultimate destiny as one single legitimate Christian nation.
So it's not just history, it's salvation history written for a nation. Perfectly put. The whole narrative covers almost 8 centuries, I think Julius Caesar's invasion in 55 BCE, right up to Bede's own time, 731 CE. And it maps out this very clear path. Starts with some early Roman Christian roots, then plunges into the sort of pagan darkness of the Anglo-Saxon invasion, which they saw as punishment.
Explicitly, divine punishment for the moral failures of the native Britons. And then out of that darkness comes the eventual, you know, triumph and consolidation of the bright kind of faith under Rome.
And a big part of achieving that unified Gens Anglorum, that English people, was sorting out the internal fights within Christianity itself.
Oh, absolutely central. Bede spends a lot of time detailing this struggle between two very different versions or streams of Christianity that were basically battling for England's soul.
Okay, so on one side, you've got the Roman Church, structured, hierarchical, coming in through Augustine's mission down in Kent.
Mm-hmm. Sent by Pope Gregory.
And on the other side,
the Celtic Church, which felt, well, fiercer, more local, definitely more ascetic. It came via Irish missionaries like Aidan, setting up shop in places like Iona and Lindisfarne. They believed the same core things, but they clashed big time on practices, who had authority, and really what it meant to be Christian in Britain.
So the book isn't just a record. It's a moral guide, maybe a foundational myth.
All of the above. It gives legitimacy to the Christian kings by slotting them into this grand divine story, and it basically hands the whole nation its identity papers.
Let's dive into the story itself then, because the bits Bede chooses to highlight really stick, don't they? Book Eye kind of sets the scene, Roman Britain falling apart, the pagan Anglo-Saxons arriving. But the real spark, the moment the English destiny kicks off, involves Pope Gregory the Great.
Ah, yes. The famous story that really launches the whole conversion effort. Gregory supposedly sees these fair-haired Anglo slave boys in the market in Rome.
Right, the Angly part.
And he makes that pivotal pun. "None Angly," said Angly. Not angles, but angels.
That line is just pure narrative gold, isn't it? Whether it actually happened exactly like that, it doesn't matter. It instantly paints the English mission with this sense of divine purpose, this sort of romantic calling.
Totally. And that vision, real or symbolic, prompts Gregory to send Augustine off to Kent in 597 CE. That secures the first major Anglo-Saxon conversion and crucially roots it firmly in Rome from the start.
Okay, so that's the South. Then book two shifts focus up north to Northumbria and the conversion of King Edwin. And this is where Bede gives us that incredibly powerful reason why paganism just wasn't enough. The sparrow allegory.
Oh, it's maybe the most famous passage in the whole book.
Yeah.
Unforgettable.
Remind us how it goes.
Well, Edwin's holding council, debating whether to convert. And one of his counselors stands up and compares human life, our existence, to a sparrow flying swiftly through a warm, bright mead hall on a freezing winter night.
Okay.
It flies in from the dark storm outside, enjoys just a brief moment of light, warmth, company, and then zooms straight back out of the blackness, the unknown storm on the other side.
Wow, that really captures it.
It perfectly captures that deep existential dread of the pagan world, right? And that total uncertainty about where we come from, where we're going after this short life. Christianity, the counselor argues, offers the answers, the light, the knowledge of before and after.
Yeah.
It's an argument based on filling that existential void.
Such a powerful pitch, but that initial success up north was shaky, wasn't it? Edwin dies, things fall apart.
Yeah, it shows how fragile those early Roman missions were, especially far from Kent. And that fragility really opens the door for book three, which brings in the other major player, the Celtic tradition. Northumbria falls back into chaos. King Oswald is in exile, and he invites monks from the Celtic heartland, from Iona. St. Aidan arrives, sets up Lindisfarne, and Bede's reaction to this Celtic influence is interesting, isn't it? He doesn't just dismiss them.
No, not at all. And this shows Bede the careful politician, maybe. He heaps praise on Aidan and the Celtic monks for their incredible personal holiness, their humility, their simple ascetic lives. He can't deny their spiritual power.
But he very carefully, very meticulously points out all their uncanonical practices. You know, calculating Easter on a different date, the way they shaved their monks' heads, seemingly small things. But Bede uses them to subtly, constantly suggest they're not quite aligned with the universal authoritative church, setting the stage for the inevitable clash. And that clash arrives with a bang in book four, the Synod of Whitby in 664, hosted by this amazing figure, Abbess Hilda. This wasn't just monks debating rules, was it? Oh, this is everything. It was basically a battle for the soul and identity of the English church, a crisis point, a proxy war for who's ultimately in charge.
Exactly.
You had the Celtic side, led by Colman, arguing from the traditions of their revered founder, St. Columba. And then you had the Roman champion, Wilfrid, arguing for the supreme universal authority of St. Peter, the rock on which the church was built. And the whole thing gets decided by King Oswy's very, very pragmatic choice.
Yeah, Oswy's logic is brilliant in a way. He cuts through all the complex theology.
Totally.
He basically asks, okay, everyone agrees St. Peter was given the keys to the kingdom of heaven by Christ, right? Both sides say, well, yes. So Oswy says.
He says, essentially, well, then I'm sticking with Peter, the doorkeeper of heaven, because when I get there, I don't want him locking me out. It wasn't about deep doctrine. It was about ultimate practical authority. And that decision locked England into the Roman sphere for centuries.
Wow. So that decision really cements the identity of the Gens Anglorum as part of the wider Roman continental world, not some isolated Celtic island fringe.
Precisely. And then book four goes on to show how Archbishop Theodore of Tarsus arrives soon after. He's the organizational genius. He comes in and starts structuring the newly unified English church, breaking up huge dioceses, setting up regular synods, enforcing consistent Roman standards everywhere. He built the institutional framework.
And book five is sort of the victory lap, the celebration of this unified church.
Pretty much. The Golden Age. And it culminates in celebrating the ultimate English saint, St. Cuthbert of Lindisfarne. He's presented as the perfect fusion, embodying that deep Celtic personal piety, but living it within the disciplined Roman structure.
The best of both worlds.
Exactly. And the English church, now unified and strong, even starts sending its own missionaries, like Willibrord, back to pagan parts of the European continent, kind of paying back the spiritual debt, showing its maturity.
Okay, so if we zoom out from the narrative, what are the big overarching themes Bede hammers home? The messages that lasted.
Well, theme one has to be the forging of identity, creating the Gens Anglorum. Bede demonstrates powerfully that it was this shared faith that created a sense of nationhood that shifting political or tribal alliances just couldn't.
Right.
The conversion process itself transformed these disparate groups into a single people with a shared story. It really underlines the power of a unifying narrative, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Even today, we organize ourselves around big stories. Absolutely. Then theme two, the ideal Christian king. Look at rulers like Edwin or Oswald. Bede praises them to the skies because they actively used their power to promote and defend Christianity. And the flip side, kings who resisted. They tended to meet bad ends in his narrative. So there's this clear message. Righteous Christian leadership leads to peace and prosperity on earth. Kingship comes with a profound moral duty. It links moral authority directly to political legitimacy. That's a timeless idea. Definitely. And theme three seems close to Bede's own heart. The monastery is the engine of civilization.
Oh, completely. As a lifelong monk surrounded by books, Bede is making the case that Christian civilization, and maybe any civilization, depends fundamentally on learning, on education.
The monasteries weren't just places of prayer. They preserved texts, transmitted knowledge. They were these stable anchors of culture in really volatile times.
It suggests that the health of a society's educational institutions is maybe a direct measure of the health of the society itself, especially when things feel unstable.
I think that's a fair reading. And Bede didn't just give us history or themes. He gave us these incredibly memorable lines, these narrative snapshots that really shaped how people remembered this whole period.
Let's revisit a couple of those key moments, those quotes. First, that sparrow allegory we talked about. Yeah. Quote one, "The present life of man, O king, seems to me like to the swift flight of a sparrow through the room." It just perfectly nails that existential fear of the unknown in the pre-Christian world and highlights why Christianity's promise of answers, of certainty, was so compelling. And then the line that kicked the whole mission off, Pope Gregory's pun, "Non angli," said Angeli.
Quote two, "It immediately frames the English as special, as divinely chosen for this mission. It sets up this whole narrative of destiny right from the start, gives a sense of, well, almost exceptionalism."
And quote three, "King Oswy's very practical reason for choosing Rome at Whitby, siding with Peter, the doorkeeper of heaven."
Mm-hmm. It shows that sometimes big historical shifts pivot not on complex arguments, but on a simple appeal to ultimate practical authority. Who holds the keys? That secured Rome's position for a very, very long time.
It's actually quite striking how lessons from managing, you know, an 8th century church structure can offer insights for today, for modern organizations even.
It really can. Application one could be leadership and institutional development, looking specifically at Archbishop Theodore.
The organizer who came in after Whitby.
Exactly. His ability to take this newly unified but still pretty fragmented English church and systematically structure it, breaking down those huge old dioceses, setting up regular meetings, synods, implementing consistent standards across the board. That's a classic case study in how you scale up an organization effectively.
So good leadership needs both the big vision and the practical, systematic follow-through. The structures matter.
They absolutely do. And application two is all about cultural integration and change management, drawing from the Synod of Whitby itself.
The clash between the Celtic and Roman ways.
Yeah. Think about modern company mergers or trying to integrate different teams with different work cultures. Often the big fights erupt over things that seem minor on the surface, like the date of Easter or maybe today, which software platform to use or office rituals.
But they're really proxies for deeper issues like identity, autonomy, whose way is right.
Precisely. Bede shows us that resolving these deep conflicts often requires, well, first, a formal process for debate, like the Synod. But critically, it often needs a decisive leader, the Oswy figure, to step in, maybe appeal to some higher or universal principle or authority, make a call, and then enforce that standardization. You can't ignore the symbolic stuff in change management.
Looking back on the whole thing, what really stands out to me, maybe what surprised me, is just how aware Bede seems to be of history as a tool, as a constructive act. He wasn't just passively recording what happened.
No, he was actively shaping it.
He was crafting this unifying story, using historical evidence, yes, but interpreting it, selecting it, framing it, all to build the future he believed in. That conscious creation of a shared identity is just...
Well, it's incredibly powerful, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
And if we try to connect this to the bigger picture, maybe the lasting lesson from Bede is that real, deep, enduring cultural transformation seems to need two things working together. You need that strong moral or philosophical foundation, the individual piety, the conviction you see in figures like Aidan or Cuthbert.
The heart.
Yeah, the heart. But you also need the robust institutional structures, the stability, the organization that people like Theodore brought. It's the fusion of the personal conviction with the organized system.
Which does make you wonder, doesn't it? What shared values, what sort of transcendent principles, if any, are holding our culture together today, especially when things feel so fragmented?
That is the big question Bede leaves us with, I think. What's our unifying story now?
Something to definitely ponder.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.